Welcome to SinoPinion, the podcast of the Center for International Security and Strategy, CISS, at Tsinghua University. We provide Chinese perspective with a global vision. I'm Dawei, Director of CISS, speaking from Beijing.
And I am Xiaoyu Qing from the Shanghai Institutes for International Studies, co-hosting today from Shanghai. It is March 29th. Exactly 1 month has passed since the US and Israel launched Operation Epic Fury against Iran. We discussed this conflict when it first broke out, but 30 days later, the war shows no signs of ending. Instead, it's sending shockwaves through the global order far from violent than many anticipated.
Joining us today to unpack this crisis is our old friend, Professor Gong Jung, or John Gong, from the University of International Business and Economics. John is a rare expert who spent over 20 years living and working in the United States, followed by 3 years in Israel. He knows the strategic DNA of Washington, the Middle East, and Beijing intimately. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dawei and Yuqin. I am joining you from Wuhu today, which is a city in Anhui province. It's a critical time to be having this conversation, and I'm glad to join SinoPinion.
John, let's start with the military deadlock, the guns part of our episode. Over the last few days, we've seen Iranian counterstrikes against United States assets and Gulf interests actually escalate. Despite the intense air campaign, Tehran's command structure seems more resilient and flattened than expected, and the regime remains stable. Do you expect the intensity of this war to keep climbing? How is Iran maintaining this level of kinetic pushback after a month of heavy bombardment?
Well, my take on this question is that it depends on what marginal gain would the United States and Israel's bombing campaign can still obtain incrementally. I'm actually very skeptical that it will get more significant targets, significant capabilities being eliminated with continued bombing. And you can see this from Washington's rhetoric. Clearly, there is indication on the part of President Trump's team that they're talking about a negotiated solution here. But nevertheless, usually, you know, the rule is that before the night of reaching agreement, probably we're going to see the most intensive fighting ongoing. So I think with the seemingly escalation of activities, the continued bombing, you know, this has to be interpreted correctly, I guess, whether this is the last bombing before the end of the tunnel, or it's on a trajectory of further escalation. So that's a tough question, I guess. I guess this question also depends on both sides' willingness to come to a conclusion of this, come to settlement of this. And it's a little bit complicated, I would say, because clearly Iran is right now, hopefully, in the process of starting negotiation or maybe already in a negotiation with Washington. It doesn't talk to Jerusalem at this point. So whether, you know, both sides, when I say both sides, meaning Washington and Tehran, whether they can reach an agreement or not, also very much depends on Israeli actions. I think it's pretty clear that by reading the news reports and commentary in Israeli media, it's pretty clear that the Israeli side doesn't want to see a negotiated term between Washington and Tehran. So, you know, I would imagine, I won't hesitate to imagine, let's put it this way, that Israel will somehow maybe engage in some kind of a sabotage activities targeting the negotiation. Israel doesn't want to see this negotiation to be successful. So I think from that perspective, Israel and the United States are not fully aligned in their interest at this stage of the conflict. So
I agree with you on this part that I don't think Israel and the United States align at this current stage. But could you elaborate more? What are the different difference is here. What is the goal right now for the Trump administration, and what is the goal right now for Israel now?
I think from the Trump administration's perspective, the talks have already been accomplished, as J.D. Vance has just put it. He said that most of the military targets' objectives have been already achieved so far. So clearly, the United States wants to withdraw, but it wants to withdraw in a decent way. It wants to withdraw not perceived as the tail between the legs, I guess. It wants to be seen as withdrawing from this in a dignified way, meaning that the strait is open, the passage of ships is safe. So I think this is probably Washington's perspective, but Israel is a little bit different. Israel's campaign is far from being completed. It's actually engaging in a fierce fighting in southern Lebanon. And also, it doesn't see what has accomplished so far in the territory of Iran being fully accomplished. I think there's probably a different view on that point.
So, John, let me ask this. I think you already discussed the differences between Washington and Israel. So let's imagine in the future, if Washington decide to ceasefire, will Israel side follow the U.S. Or will they fight separately?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's definitely possible that they will. Israel is likely maybe to reach a agreement with Tehran sort of under the table, but without sort of openly talking about it. I mean, there are precedents like this before. Both sides quietly stop bombing each other. That's quite likely. But that doesn't mean that the war with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon is going to stop. And of course, Iranians are not going to abandon their friends in southern Lebanon. So in a way, this proxy war is still going on. I guess we could call it a proxy war within a proxy war, put it this way. it's kind of a bizarre in my view. It's kind of a shameful in my view, speaking from Washington's perspective, that the United States can be used as the agent in a proxy war, whereas in the past, the United States has always been a principal in engaging other agents to fight wars for the United States. But clearly, this is time the United States is acting an agent for Israel, as some congressmen have already pointed out. I can't remember the exact names, but I think there's plenty of talk in Washington, essentially describing a war like that. Isn't this bizarre and shameful that the United States can be acting as an agent for a foreign country in a war, in an active war? But
say this is a so-called tail wag dog?
Absolutely. You definitely can describe it this way. I think I see that there's a lot of information, put it this way. There's a lot of information in that resignation letter by Joe Kent, who is the counterterrorism official in the United States. He's reporting directly to Tulsi Gabbard, right, who is the director of national intelligence. In this letter, he said very clearly that Israel pitched a plan to Washington, stating that once the bombing started, the regime in Iran is going to crumble. And it's going to turn into a regime change in Iran. And I think it makes a lot of sense looking back right now why Washington has been very evasive and has been convoluted with respect to the goals of this so-called war of choice. Because it's clear to me that the aim of this goal is about regime change. But looking back, two or three days after the bombing started, the United States cannot talk about regime change anymore. It cannot state that regime change as the goal, because it totally failed, right? How can you talk about a goal again if you fail that goal? But looking back, I think it's indeed objective at the very beginning, a failed objective in the beginning. And that's why Joe Kent was talking about Washington being essentially talking to a war by Bibi Netanyahu for a reason that never materialized. I think that's really what happened so far.
Yuqing, let me ask you a question, Yuqing. Yeah, I think John's view is probably he thinks President Trump and the U.S. government is quite careful, you know, not to be trapped in Iran. But we are still seeing, you know, we are still reading the reports from media that U.S. is sending their ground troops or Marines to the region. So how high, in your view, is the risk that U.S. gets bogged down in Iran, like what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan before?
Personally, I don't have the answer. Actually, it's the question that I'm going to ask John. But since you asked me, my sense is that because I agree with John's view that for Washington these days, the goal is to withdraw from Iran in a decent way. At the same time, for example, President Trump can announce that we win the operation and we have reached our goal. But the biggest challenge is whether the Strait of Hormuz can be open, can be safe. But right now, according to the U.S. media, the Pentagon is preparing for weeks of ground operations. And just like Iraq, just like Afghanistan, the U.S. administration would send more troops on the ground in order to withdraw in a decent way. So this time, if they send more Marines, more troops, soldiers to Iraq on the ground to do those operations, the question on my mind is whether they can use those troops to achieve the goal of regime change. If they cannot do that, how they can protect the Strait of Hormuz, how they can let this strait be open, be safe to let all the ships to move through the strait. I think these things are contradicting with each other. I just don't know how they can achieve that goal, I mean, to withdraw in a decent way. It's my view.
Yeah. Well, let me pitch in regarding this actually very important question. First of all, you know, it's absolutely clear that the troops stands by the United States so far is no way close even to achieve the goal of regime change. There's no way. It's absolutely no way. 10,000 troops, you know, conquering a country, you know, with a population of 90 million people, there's no way they can conquer the whole country and seek a regime change. So I think this is totally off the table. So exactly, you know, there's some analysis saying that even just to control the coastal area of Iran that is close to the Strait of Hormuz, meaning that control of the Kashan Island to the northwestern part of the strait, and also the coastal area around the coast to the northeast of the strait, would require 80,000 troops at least. 80,000 troops at least. So I think, you know, this 10,000 soldiers sent to the region is not, it's not only not even close to a regime change, but it's even not even close to securing the strait in a way that essentially occupy part of Iran from a more of a permanent basis, right? And that's not even remotely close in my view. So I think what can happen when we say open the strait or make the strait safe? I mean, what we really mean by that? I think it's quite possible that United States can secure the strait, you know, can be briefly for maybe a few weeks, a month maybe, and then just withdraw this from this place forever, right? Because as President Trump has said, that this strait has nothing to do with the United States' national interests. I mean, Washington is not relying on that strait. So if that's the case, why would it so much be, you know, concerned about opening the strait on a permanent basis, right? It only needs an excuse and only needs a basis for declaring a victory. And you know, this opening doesn't have to be very long. So I'm suspecting, I'm actually very speculative on this point. I'm suspecting that, you know, this 10,000 troops would go there, maybe, you know, occupying a small little island in the middle of the strait, and some ships are passing. Maybe even the agreement wasn't reached with the Iranians under the table, that it won't bother with the Americans for maybe a few weeks. And President Trump just go ahead to declare victory and withdraw from this or whatever. And then from that point on, the passage of the ships across the strait is going to be a bilateral issue between the country that owns this ship or you know controls the ship with Iran. And that's an interesting situation. I mean, that's why I think you know American allies in Europe are very careful about taking a stand on this issue. Probably they understand that if they you know stake out a very strong position against Iran, there might be long-term consequences for days to come when America has no control of that strait. So that's just my speculation. I don't know. I mean, it's just it's very speculative at this point, I would say.
Yeah, I will say yes, definitely. If the U.S. want to go or want to leave, they can leave whenever they want. But the problem, the challenge is if there's no regime change and maybe at the same time, you can say the U.S. and Israel weakened the Iranese nuclear and the missile capability. But in the future, Iran can rebuild their capability. So watching all this, you know, happening, it seems to me that the more the U.S. and Israel strike, the more Iran feels it has no choice but to, you know, build its ultimate shield, that is nuclear weapons. So are we witnessing a strategic paradox where the attempt to prevent a nuclear Iran is actually the very thing making a nuclear Iran inevitable? Are we going to see Iran after this war, you know, rebuild its nuclear program and maybe passing past the nuclear threshold very soon?
Okay. All right. Well, this reminds me of Israeli strategy in dealing with Hamas. The Israelis have a mentality that, you know, this is actually before October 7th, 2022. The Israelis have a mentality that they have to deal with Hamas every 6 or 7 years. So, you know, based on their plan, they were just going to Gaza or going to the West Bank, you know, to deal a military blow to the militants in these two regions, and curtail back their capabilities. And usually an operation like this can last 6 to 7 years, and after that they come back again. So this is the Israeli mentality towards Hamas back then. I think in this case, it might be the same thing. You know, Israel can never occupy Iran. It looks like this case, in this time, it's not able to incur a regime change. So the next best option would be just to do this similarly as with Hamas. You just bomb Iranian facilities once every 6, 7 years, you know, roll it back. Iran will come back again and then start another war. So I think Israel probably doesn't have much of a choice here. There's two countries in between Iran and Israel, right? It can never go into Iran. It can never force a regime change. And the only way to curtail back Iranians' military capability, ballistic missile capability, nuclear capability is just through area bombing. And I suspect that if it comes to that stage, that's what Israelis will do. It's just going every, you know, once every 6, 7 years.
Now, I guess we can move to the economic part of our episode, which is gas. Currently, 21% of global seaborne oils passes through the Strait of Hormuz. If this war drags on, what does the math of survival look like for the global economy? How long can strategic petroleum reserves actually last? If this reaches the 3-month or 6-month mark, what are the systemic risks to global markets?
I think the oil price is actually a little bit better than I expected, actually. Right now, it's hovering around $100 per barrel. $100 per barrel, well, let me first say the following. I remember in a few days into the war, the war's already started, the oil price only shot up to $80 per barrel, much to my surprise, I think. What it means is that the market actually has very moderate expectation of this war. I mean, people, investors, speculators are expecting there's not going to be a severe impact on the global economy. Otherwise, you know, oil price will be shooting up, right? But then I think once the oil facility is being hit by Israeli side in Iran, the oil price immediately shot up to over $100, right? But there's also a report at the time that this action on the Israeli part was heavily, heavily scolded by Washington, right? And Washington immediately told the Israelis, the IDF, that stop doing that. And then the prices stopped, you know, shot back at climbed down a little bit. I think right now it's around like $100. Now, let me say that the $100 per barrel is not something that is extraordinarily high that will destroy the world economy. It's not going to happen that way. I think we have seen this price level, you know, a couple of times in the past. We even have seen oil prices over $120 per barrel, I think several years ago. So, you know, my view is that $100 per barrel is something that the global economy can live with, even though it's a little bit more difficult. Now, the problem is that even though oil futures prices are around $100, there's a report that if you actually buy oil from, say, countries like Qatar, from Kuwait, the price is a lot higher than this. So what it means is that, you know, the 20% of the oil, the global oil supply, is actually being priced at a much, much higher price, right? So so what's the impact on that? You know, what are the countries that are being affected by this? I think there are actually not many countries being affected by this. I'm being a little bit more optimistic at this point. Countries like Japan, South Korea, some European countries, they are actually being heavily impacted on this. The largest import of oil from the region, China, I think is impacted much to a lesser extent. We have a very large oil reserve, reportedly 3 to 4 months of oil reserve. We're also buying oil from Russia. I'm pretty sure we're buying more oil from Russia these days. And Russia alone can make up, you know, the shortage of oil from the be impacted by the Middle East, by coming from the Strait of Hormuz. So I think the impact on China is probably a little bit less than many analysts expected. I mean, think about this. China, NDRC officially raised the price of gasoline, I think it's 2 or 3 weeks after the war erupted, right? And also the price increase is actually not that much in my view. So I think there's going to be an impact on global economy, but it's not going to be a killing effect. In other words, it's not going to put the global economy upside down. I think that's not going to happen. Provided, let's say, assuming that the war is going to be winding down fairly soon. But if this thing is going on, dragging on, you know, for weeks and weeks on, and also the oil facilities are being destroyed, not just in Iran, but also in other GCC countries, like in UAE, in Qatar, Qatar is not part of GCC, but in UAE, in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia. If that's the case, then we're talking about a totally different story here. The Iranian side has made it very clear that if their oil facilities are being hit, they're going to retaliate, right? So I think that's a very different scenario. And so far, United States and Israel haven't done that.
So far, it's not that bad. It sounds like that. But I guess one important thing is the overall military operation has led the Gulf region The plan was the Gulf region countries, they would like to become a source and destination of international investment. Right now, the security situation has changed this scenario quite much, I think.
Yeah, right? Well, I think that narrative is totally destroyed. If anything, you know, the biggest victim of this whole conflict is probably UAE. You know, you think about how much damage this is going to inflict on Dubai, right? It used to be a place with so many international investors. People buy properties there. I think it's going to take, you know, maybe a decade, over a decade to recover, if at all. I mean, there's a precedent here. I think the Iranian side was once talking about this, you know, before the era of Dubai, it was the Kuwait City. People go to Kuwait City. And then there was an economic boom in Kuwait City. And then, you know, Kuwait got invaded by Iraq and all well, that happened during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And Kuwait never recovered, actually. Never, ever recovered, you know, to the extent that, to the extent of, you know, as its leading role in the Gulf region. Today, it's Dubai. And will Dubai follow the same footsteps as Kuwait City? I think the jury is still out there. Anyway, Dubai is suffering a huge loss here, a huge, huge loss, you know, hundreds of billions of loss, I would say.
Yeah, I think the economic impact in the short term, I agree with John, that I think it's not very high. But my concern is because we don't know how when will this conflict end? If it lasts for, let's say, another 3 months, I think that will be, you know, quite serious for the world economy. And people here sitting in Beijing, I think, are watching this because not only the energy price, if this war continue for months, then that could you know, raise the possibility of a global recession, economic recession in other countries. And then that will also give China a lot of, that will deteriorate China's external economic environment, while China, of course, definitely still rely on exportation very much in our,
right,
in our economy. So, John, do you share with that view?
Yeah, Professor Dawei, I totally agree with you. I think if this war prolongs, there's going to be a severe impact on global economy, and that inevitably including China. You know, from China's perspective, I think the impact of this war, the economic impact of this war, is actually quite complicated. I mean, on the one hand, we're going to incur losses. The Middle East represents a huge market, export market, as you said, from China's perspective. We actually export a lot of cars to the Middle East, electric cars to Israel, the state of Israel. When I was living in Israel, I have seen, you know, just a rapid increase of Chinese-made EVs on streets of Israel. All of this is gone right now, I guess, right? And God knows when it's going to recover. But on the other hand, and then, so of course, there's the negative impact of high oil prices on China's economy. That's for sure. It's a negative thing. But on the other hand, I think, you know, there's some talk about, from a long-term strategic point of view, the importance of alternative energies, right, is getting more emphasized. And that's just where Chinese industries, Chinese companies shine. You know, we are the leader, we are the dominant leader, actually, in solar panel. We are the dominant leader in wind power. We are the dominant leader in storage technologies, energy storage technologies. All of these things, I would imagine, would be selling very well moving forward. There was a so-called excess capacity, for example, in the solar panel industry here in China. I'm not sure anymore, given, you know, the current situation. I think Europe, many European countries are scrambling to build solar farms, for example, you know, to meet energy need. This kind of oil prices are hurting the Europeans. So I don't know the net effect of this, right? If somebody's going to do a net effect analysis about the impact on China's economy, that would be interesting. But at least I can see that there are positive sides, but there are also negative sides. But at the end of the day, you know, we don't want a war. A war is always bad. I think it doesn't make sense to talk about good things for China coming out of a war. We like to have peace, of course, yeah.
Yeah, of course, we don't like war. Dawei, can I ask you, what do you think of the implications for Europe? And I guess it's also bad for Europe. And also, how do you see the implications on transatlantic relations?
Yes, I think we already discussed a lot about the military issues, the economic issues, and when we discuss this war, you know, the U.S., Israel, Iran are always be mentioned, and I think I will going to say more about China later. But there is another quieter player, or I will say, yeah, maybe not a player, but a stakeholder here is Europe. My understanding is that this is another strike on the transatlantic relationship because the U.S. launched the war, but without telling their European allies. Well, but this war definitely have, you know, a kind of impact on European countries, because after the war in Ukraine, Europe has already cut their energy links with Russia. So they very much relied on the Middle East energy supply. But now that part, that lifeline is on fire. So the U.S. has launched this campaign without consulting the European allies and leave them sidelined once again. I think that's another. So that's the reason why I said it's a strike again. U.S.-Europe relations after, you know, so many bad news from the European perspective this year. At the same time, I think now another crisis, another war is kind of being neglected now by the media. That is the war in Ukraine. So I think definitely because U.S. is preoccupied in the Middle East, I think their attention to the war of Ukraine may be even further decreased. And probably because of the rise of the oil price, I think Russia is weeping quietly and, you know, get benefits from this war. So that will give Russia probably more resources fighting the war in Ukraine. And I think Ukrainians are facing more difficult geopolitical environment and also international environment. So I don't know if Professor Gong agree with me. He is an expert on the war in Ukraine. So John, what's your view on this?
Well, I totally agree with you. I think you hit right on the mark. There's actually already reports that United States is diverting weapons in the Pearl program to the Middle East already. The program is a program for providing weapons to Ukraine, which is funded by money from Europe, right? I think the Europeans have already paid $700-800 million, and all these weapons, you know, supposedly go to Ukraine. America says, "I'm sorry, you know, we need this at this point," and they divide all these things to the Middle East. I think this is already a huge blow to the Ukrainian side. I guess President Zelensky is very furious about this, but nevertheless, it cannot do a thing. And if you look at the what's happening on the battlefield, clearly the Russians are steadily marching. I people still using the word stalemate to describe what's happening in Ukraine. I totally disagree with that. I think, the Russians are steadily making progress. In today's environment, military environment, with the drones flying over your head all the time, we're not going to talk about breakthroughs of, 10 kilometers a day, something like that. It's not going to happen. Essentially, it's a positional advancement, steady positional advancement. And the Russians have been maintaining this, very steady pace for over, at least a year now. They're making, 600, 700 square kilometers a month. They have conquered Pokrovsk, which is a, sort of a symbolic city, right? It's an important fortress in Ukraine, and it was lost. So I think, with this background we'll be discussing here, the Russians are further, marching east. I'm sorry, further marching west for sure. They are steadily making progress in the northern city, in Kharkiv, in Kupiansk. They are making progress in Lyman. And I think I read today's Washington Post, an article there. They're talking about before the end of the year, the Russians are going to march to the last two cities in Donbas, in Donetsk, Oblast, which are Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. These are the lasting, the fortresses on the Ukrainian side. So I think definitely you are right, Dawei, that the Russians gain a lot from this. And they also see an interest, actually, in this war in the Middle East, in Iran, continuing. I mean, they're actually helping the Iranians, right? In this report of providing military assistance to the Iranian side. So they probably have an interest in seeing this war ongoing. That's the cruelty of geopolitics, I guess.
Yes. So there's a saying, some people say this is from Mark Twain, but actually maybe not. That is, history never repeats itself, but it always rhymes. So some strategists are calling the war in Iran as the Suez moment for American hegemony. So they are referring to 1956, when the U.S. forced the U.K. and France to retreat after they seized the Suez Canal, actually signaling the end of the British Empire. So back then, the Egyptian president Nasser sank ships to block the canal, Suez Canal, cutting Europe's oil by two-thirds. So, John, looking at the Strait of Hormuz today in 2026, are we witnessing the Suez moment of the American century?
I think there's a major difference here in that there is no the equivalent role of the United States here in this case. Compared with the Suez moment, America and Israel are only fighting against Iranians. China is not involved. Russia is not significantly involved directly, and it's a I don't think it's going to get into a world war kind of a scenario. I think the end result of this war very much depends on how resilient, how persevering the Iranians can be against the backdrop of even tighter sanctions, even more stringent measures to cut the Iranian economy from the rest of the world. I think that's the challenge here. Let me say a few words. From China's perspective, we certainly would like to see oil still coming out of Iran, coming to China. We certainly have that interest. But even if that is indeed cut off, I think it's not much of a big deal from China's perspective. I mean, the total oil supply from Iran, I remember seeing it's less than 4%, I think, from total China's oil imports. And that's not a very significant number, right? But to Iran, it's a totally different story. I mean, this is it's its bloodline. It is the most important revenue source for the Iranian government. I mean, the entire government is relying upon that. So I think from that angle, we can argue that, you know, China is actually in a very unique position here. We have already designated a special envoy to the Middle East and tried to, you know, work out something. It's my hope that actually China's envoy plays a more proactive role, more important role in working out a solution here, because China's role in this negotiation carries much more weight, I would say, than say Pakistan or Qatar, I guess.
Yeah. So follow your comment on this. I guess a lot of curiosity about China's role recently. Of course, we have seen the news of our special envoy. I think the outside world, I've been asked by quite many European colleagues, U.S. colleagues, that whether Beijing would like to take direct action to mediate, to play a more active role here, or perhaps by pushing for an UN Security Council intervention, or joining a multilateral mediation led by non-Western or regional powers. So how do you see that possibility?
Well, first of all, I think a joint union action, I mean, when I say action, meaning it's something more than just a statement coming from the Security Council. I don't think that's going to happen. You know, UN has sunk to the level that it's more of a place for talking, I guess, for advocating. It's not much of a role for indeed mediating peace right now. I mean, it can send a peace corps after the settlement has already reached, but you know, in terms of working out a settlement, you know, I'm very skeptical. Nevertheless, I think the idea of China working with other Arab countries to come up with a solution is actually an intriguing idea to me. I think one thing is very different now compared to the situation before the war is that the Arab countries, I mean, mostly the GCC countries, have now come to understand that hosting military bases for the United States is not going to help them. They would hope that this is going to provide protection for these countries, but if anything, you know, what we are seeing is the exact opposite. All right, so I think they come to realize that relying on the United States hosting American troops on their soil is not the whole solution, or at least it's not the complete solution. They got to be looking for other options here, and I think working with China is an intriguing and interesting idea. I would imagine that there would be more arms being sold from China to these countries. This is my wild guess, is that, you know, China's foreign policy has been traditionally being a sort of a minimalist intervention policy, essentially, right? You know, it doesn't want to get involved in other countries' business, being that far away. It typically, you know, we don't want to interfere in other countries' internal affairs. That has always been a tradition in China's foreign policy. But given the immense national interest at stake here from China's perspective, I would argue for a more of a, I won't say interventionist, but I would call it more of a proactive role in working towards peace, right? You know, what's wrong with working towards peace? So I think, I would advocate for a more proactive role from China's perspective.
Yeah. Dawei, how do you see that?
Yes, I think I basically agree with Professor Gong, and when he said China's foreign policy is kind of minimal interference, right? So here, I think we need to differentiate this, interfere or mediating the conflicting parties from non-interference principle. China definitely have, you know, for a very long time, non-interference policy or principle, but that is no intervention to the domestic affair of other countries. So it's not that China will never interfere conflicts. China actually in past few years has been playing a bigger and a bigger role in the mediation, international mediation. Of course, at the same time, I do agree that China is pretty new in the global mediating effort. And the Middle East is very far from China. China's interest is, I would say, it's important, but it's limited. It's not a vital interest. But I do want to see more Chinese mediating role, either by ourselves or working with other countries, particularly the regional countries, because not only because we support peace and we have this global security initiative, and also Iran for a very long time is China's strategic partner, and we have also very good relations with GCC countries. So, and the Middle East is important for the Belt and Road Initiative of China. So for all these reasons, I think China can play some role and should play some role. And the last point I want to say is U.S.-China relations. So President Trump said that he's going to visit China in May 14 and 15. So I don't know whether this war will be ended before that summit. I hope so. But no matter whether it will be end or not by that time, I think Iran issue will definitely be a major issue in the summit between China and the United States. So doing something helping the conflict or the war to be ended and contribute to the peace effort, I think will put China in a very good position in this summit. If not, I think, if the war is still going on, then China received President Trump in Beijing. I think that image is not very good, to be honest. I hope China can, in this high-level, presidential-level exchanges can be a platform, can be a venue that China play a role, helping all the, related party to end the conflict and the war as soon as possible.
Yes, I agree with you that if President Trump can visit Beijing in the mid of May, I think the summit meeting will be a platform to the two leaders of two great countries to talk about peace and development. It's not a kind of a G2 format, and it's not a kind of thinking that some Americans would speculate, that the Chinese would say that when your opponent is making a mistake, don't interrupt him. Just keep the United States trapped in Iran and in Middle East, and that will be in China's interest. I think that logic is kind of a old style. Today, I think the China's economy overall is a global one, and the regional peace in Middle East at the end of the day is in China's interest. So I agree with both of you that China's diplomacy should be more proactive.
Yes, I think that really depends on how do we view this war. Should we view this just from purely zero-sum China-US confrontation, or should we view it from the, as we always say, the community of shared future of human being? I think if from the latter, China definitely is part of the global economy, and also, of course, the whole world. So China can play and should play a more proactive role. Okay, so with that, I think it's the end of our time. So thank you, Professor Gong Jun, Zhang Gong, and thank you to my co-host, Yiqun. So today we discussed the deadlock of the U.S.-Israel-Iran conflict and the potential disastrous effect on the region and the world.
Thank you for listening to Sinopinion, Chinese Perspectives, Global Vision. For more insights from Chinese scholarship on international affairs, please follow or subscribe to our podcast. Until next time.